Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The true story of the murder of April Kaufman, a beloved and vivacious local radio personality and veterans advocate who was found shot to death in the bedroom of her home in Linwood, New Jersey in May of 2012. In the months leading up to her death, she had uncovered a tangled web of deceit surrounding her husband. She feared he was trying to kill her and that he may harm her family. Her daughter, Kim Pack, never doubted her stepfather, Dr. James Kaufman, was responsible somehow. Reporter Annie McCormick met Kim Pack on the first anniversary of her mother's murder. Over the next 5 years, McCormick tracked the case. She continued to gather information to uncover the doctor's web of lies. Dr. Kaufman shunned the media and his stepdaughter, moving on with his life in the same town. Meanwhile, investigators uncovered how the doctor worked with the outlaw motorcycle gang, the Pagans, to run a prescription pill mill out of his New Jersey office. More illegal deeds would catch the attention of the FBI and DEA. McCormick details the twists and turns in the investigation that dragged on for years until investigators caught an unexpected break that sparked a string of arrests, including the arrest of the doctor and several former members of the Pagans. Nearly 6 years later, authorities charged her husband, Dr. James Kaufman, with her murder. In 2018, a jury convicted a former leader of the Pagans Motorcycle Club with helping to carry out the murder. McCormick concludes never before seen or heard details from the investigation through her years of covering the case, and she documents the relentless search for justice by April's family, friends, and her daughter. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Doctor, The Hitman, and The Motorcycle Gang, the true story of one of New Jersey's most notorious murder-for-hire plots, with my special guest, journalist and author, Annie McCormick. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Annie McCormick.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. A very, very fascinating tale, The Doctor, The Hitman, and The Motorcycle Gang. I'll just tell our audience before we start off how you came to be in a position to write this book.
Well, I am a general assignment reporter for the ABC affiliate in Philadelphia. And probably a couple months before I came to Philadelphia, I was working in a different market in Pennsylvania, and I was visiting. I'm from the Philadelphia, South Jersey area. I grew up in southern New Jersey. And just to give your listeners a little bit of an idea, when we say southern Jersey, it's because North Jersey and South Jersey are very different. South Jersey kind of is a little bit closer to Philly, so we identify more with Philly, including our sports teams, Philadelphia.
Right.
And North Jersey is more for New York. And the Jersey Shore is where all of this took place. And so I had been home actually visiting my parents, and the breaking news came on, and I actually saw it play out on the station that I would end up working for. And it was just one of those cases of something that just didn't happen in that area. Everybody was, you know, wondering about it, fascinated about it. And then a couple months later, I got hired at Channel 6 Extra News in Philly. And then I'd always had this case on my mind. And a year later, I got assigned the one-year anniversary to kind of see where the investigation was at. And there was a vigil that was being held that night. And that day is the day that I met April's daughter, Kim. And from there, we just clicked and we stayed in touch. And over the course of the next number of years, I just could never get this case off my mind. And there was just so many things about it, things that were frustrating about it and about how it wasn't getting solved. And it felt like nothing was being done by investigators. They weren't forthcoming about things. and there were tons of rumors. And so through it all, Kim and I would, you know, she would kind of tell me bits and pieces about what she was hearing about the investigation, but all she really wanted was just for it to be solved. And
right.
at the same time, she also had to live in the same community with the man who she believed was responsible for it in some way, shape, or form, which is her stepfather, Dr. Jim Kaufman. And I think that
right.
that's part of the case that really kind of just really honestly fascinated me, was that this man was just going about life as normal in this community. She has to live among him, and nobody's talking about, outwardly at least, that he probably had someone hired to kill his wife. And because of that, that's what kind of really kept me fascinated about the story.
Absolutely. Let's go back to Kim Pack, her mother, April, the former April Favozzo. Tell our audience about April, a little bit about her life growing up. Before we talk about when she gave birth to Kimberly in 1982, tell us a little bit about this background and the birth and her relationship with the father of Kim. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So April grew up in Absecon, New Jersey, which if you're familiar with Atlantic City, it's one of the towns that's just outside of Atlantic City on the mainland. Atlantic City's right, right on the Jersey Shore right there, probably just 5 minutes away. And
right.
she was raised, she was born to her mom. It wasn't the best home life when she was younger. In fact, her mom ended up giving up her brothers and sisters for adoption, but kept April. And
right.
her mom had a lot of different suitors in and out of the house, some of which were abusive to a certain extent to April. And at some point, April's grandmother really became the one that was the primary maternal figure and pretty much took over raising her. So when April was in high school, I mean, first of all, she's gorgeous. I mean, just a natural beauty knockout. This is even before, the Botoxes and the, plastic surgery. She just was a natural
right.
beauty. And she just had this personality that everyone described her as someone you just really wanted to be around, a really big personality, warm, generous, funny. And she met Kim's dad, who was a couple years older than her, and she got pregnant while she was still in high school. And she went ahead and she got together with Kim's dad and she had Kim, and the relationship didn't last long, but they were never enemies by any means. They always kept a really good relationship and remained friends actually up until her death. But it was really up to April to be the one to be the breadwinner in order to raise Kim. And I think because of the type of upbringing that she had, whether it was very unstable, she kind of didn't know if there was going to be food on the table. That was all the kind of things that she didn't want for her daughter. And
right.
she really wanted Kim to have the American dream. And April was very much, somebody who was proud to be an American. She had family members in the military. And she really believed that if you worked hard, you did the right thing, you were a good person, that you could have a beautiful life. And because of that, she did everything that she could as a young single mom. She went ahead, she got her cosmetology license. She worked in hair salons. She did nails at people's homes for a while. This is during the time, the 80s of Atlantic City, where it was, the casinos were thriving. She actually got hired by a modeling agency that is a very long time modeling agency at the Jersey Shore that a lot of people know about that are on the pageant circuit. And she
right.
didn't go in to do any pageants or anything, but she was did cocktail waitressing. That's who they used to hire the people to work in the casinos at that time. And she was a hard worker. She was a hustler, not in a nefarious sense, a hustler in the sense of she was always just working hard, doing as many jobs as she could. And she had a really good support system in her friends around her. It wasn't necessarily her family. And that was kind of another thing that really played into what April would always crave as
right.
she continued on into life, was really having a big, happy home with big holidays and, you know, food never being an issue on the table. So all of that she instilled in Kim as Kim was growing up. And because of that, she did an excellent job in her daughter, Kim, in the sense that, you know, Kim went to, you know, went to high school. She graduated. She went to college, graduated early. Kim now has a successful career. But it was really hard for April. You know, and Kim tells stories about waiting in line, you know, at the grocery store and, you know, looking down at her mom's Keds, her sneakers, and she had holes in them and she was counting change in her hand because they didn't always have the money to have food as Kim was growing up, but she always knew what her mom's end game was. She always knew that her mom said, you know, it might be hard now, but I'm doing this job and that job and that job so that we don't have to live like this forever. So you don't have to have this hand to mouth type life. And she was successful in that. She got married again. And that marriage didn't last. In fact, she was going through a divorce from her second husband, who was also a doctor in the area. And actually she had actually met Dr. Kaufman, her final husband, through her second husband. And so at the time that she met Dr. Jim Kaufman, she was in the middle of, you know, a pretty tumultuous divorce, as it was described by her family and friends. And he kind of came in at that moment in her life where, even though she really had a lot together and life seemed pretty good, it was a rough time. She was vulnerable. And, you know, this man came into her life and she thought he was the answer. She thought this was the man that she was going to grow old with. And that was probably around the time that Kim was in high school.
Now, what did Jim Kaufman, you say he's 15 years older than April, first off. But what are some of the kinds of things that impressed her? You say that she had been, you know, struggling for quite a while. So what are some of the things that impressed her about Jim Kaufman?
I think that she did like the fact that, you know, he was a very well-known doctor. He was successful in his own right. But when she got to know him on a more personal level, one of the first things he said to her and their first date that they had was about being a veteran. And he talked to her about serving in Vietnam. They both liked motorcycles. April liked, you know, fast cars, motorcycles. He was into that as well. And on their first date, they took a motorcycle ride down to the Vietnam Memorial. And
right.
She was really moved by how passionate he was about his service in the military. Like I said, she had had family members that were in the military. And it was kind of another layer of him. You know, when you get to know people, you get to know more sides of them. It made
right.
him just really seem like a protector, her friends say. And she was proud of that. She was proud of him for the service that he described having done in his life.
What was James Kaufman's life growing up, as opposed to the life that April had? What was his life and his background like?
Well, for starters, their personalities are really different. So April's really, you know, her whole life really outgoing, you know, just she's a magnet. You know, so many people are just drawn to her. Jim, in contrast, was more quiet. He was reserved. His upbringing was also a lot different. As far as his family life, while he had, you know, what appeared to be a really stable family life with having, you know, a mom and a dad and the home and, you know, there wasn't a revolving door of, you know, other men like it was for, you know, her family describes as how it was for her mother. But his family life was different in the sense that his mom had come over from to New Jersey from England at the time around the Holocaust. And according to Jim, what he describes, his father Jack said that he fought in World War II. And Jim would tell a story consistently to friends, both that he grew up with and friends later in life, that his dad would tell the story of being the only man in his platoon to survive an attack during the war, making him the hero. But Jim would then tell people that his father had, you know, great amount of, you know, anxiety and depression over what he went through serving in the war. I don't know if his dad ever actually served in the war. And even though that was a story that he would tell frequently, according to family and friends, it's something that people, you know, as they go on and uncover some things, had doubts of that story. But the way that a girlfriend that was in his life at the time described his house was she called it a very difficult household. She said it was just very sad. Friends growing up said that he didn't really want to bring people over to his house. His relationship with his parents was very cold. And later, Jim would actually open up when he himself hit some difficulties during around the time of his college, saying that it was actually a traumatic upbringing. And he at times thought that there was something wrong with him, that he was, in fact, in his own words, psychotic. He thought that the upbringing had that much of a dramatic effect on him into his adulthood. But never anything bad ever was, you know, reported. There was no, you know, issues with police. There was no issues of abuse, nothing of that nature. In fact, his dad he owned a bar with another person in town. Jim went on like breaks from college or summers in high school, would drive a beer truck for his dad. So, I mean, they were functioning on the outside, you know, good members of society. And there wasn't anything outwardly, you know, horrible that people ever saw with his family. Now, Jim growing up was interesting in the sense that a lot of people that grew up with him, they actually had a nickname for him. They called him the Mad Bomber. And I mean, again, it can go two ways, you know, like the little boy that they describe as being Jim Kaufman, and they would call him Jimmy, is they said that he liked to do things like take a magnifying glass and put them over ants in the sun, obviously burns and kills ants. You know, I mean, is that the worst thing in the world? Does that make you a surefire, you know, killer? I don't know. No. I personally probably wouldn't have done it as a little kid, but at the same time, you wouldn't throw somebody in jail for doing it. But he also had a real fascination with explosives. And I think that I thought was important to include in the book, because I think it kind of plays a role into what he was fascinated about in adulthood, which ends up being ammo and guns. But he would, you know, take his little self as a little boy, you know, only 11 years old, down to the drugstore. And at the time, when he grew up in the 60s, you could actually still buy like bullets in the hardware store. And so he would actually go down there and buy all the things you need to do to put together an explosive. He'd get the fuse for it, and he'd make these little bombs in his backyard and set them off. And he'd say to his friends, hey, come over, you know, look at the bombs that I have. And so they nicknamed him the Bad Bomber, not because he was doing anything bad, but at the same time, when I would talk to people who grew up with him, I'd say, well, okay, so you called him the Bad Bomber. Like, was that joking around with him? And they said, well, no, you know, it's something more of that we called him behind his back, you know, and they described him as being a guy that's a little bit off, a little bit, there was a disconnect is what people describe. But in high school, he wasn't like the guy that was, you know, angry, plotting against people. He just was a quiet guy that kind of kept to himself.
He wasn't a very big guy, you write, too. He's about 5'9" and not a big guy overall.
Sure. Yeah. And he really got kind of into more of his physical fitness I think as he got older. But yeah, no, he was a small guy. And April, in contrast, you know, was a tall, buxom, curvy woman. And yeah. Again, it just kind of, it's like they were really two opposites. Like when you would take a step back and look at the two of them, some people say that when he met April, he really came alive more in the sense that he loved everything that came with her because she had the ability to bring people together. She had the ability to make things happen. She wanted to do philanthropy for whatever type of cause, she could do it. And there was a part of him that really thrived on that. He, in his own right, already was established, already was well-respected in the medical field. Just to give your listeners a little bit of an idea, in that area of southern New Jersey in the 90s, there really weren't a lot of people that lived around there full-time. In that part of New Jersey, it's more we'll go on weekends if you live in New York or Philadelphia. And so the medical practices, specifically he's an endocrinologist, which tends to, you know, treat people with a number of ailments, including, you know, diabetes, a lot of things that people later in life might get. So the older population. So he was really one of the first endocrinologists in that area. And because he started at a time where there wasn't that many people, and now it's a very populated area, he really had the stronghold in that region. And he also had started working with the hospital in the area, and plus he was on the speaking circuit for pharmaceutical companies. So when April came into his life, she really became, you know, his assistant in a lot of ways as far as booking speaking engagements, keeping a schedule, and she always had a big social life. And so when they got together, she took that social life with her. I mean, he did too, and he was married before, but they really became this kind of dynamic duo. And on top of it, the cause that really touched her about him was the fact that he was a veteran. And she really kind of took that and thought, you know, we can really help people in the military and people who are, you know, veterans of the military, and we can do a lot of good. And one of the things that they started doing to make a tradition for themselves is on Thanksgiving, since they're, you know, near the ocean, there's Coast Guard facilities at the Jersey Shore, and they have this thing every year where they host people can host Coast Guard cadets for Thanksgiving. And that was something that the Kaufmans really took a lot of pride in. April cooked the entire meal. They sent limos to pick the cadets up. They would put a phone in a private room so they could each have time to call their families. Just really went out of their way. And April she had so many things that she did. I almost feel like I wish I could have had an entire chapter in the book just about all of the good that she did, because there were a lot of different programs. There was something she even created at the Corvette Museum in Kentucky, which was this Vets for Vets program, where it was the Corvette Museum brought veterans over and they, you know, showered them with attention and a parade. And she would, that's the type of person she was. It wasn't just, hey, I'm going to do this. This is going to be my cause. I'm going to throw some money at it, you know, monthly, and maybe throw one fundraiser. It was like all of a sudden there was like parades, and you know, it just, she really took it to another level. And Jim was also totally on board with that. And in fact, not only was he a well-respected doctor who his patients, even after all of this tangled web unravels, still say he was a great doctor. Other people that worked alongside with April and Jim in doing the veterans causes, they even said that he was totally, and, you know, they describe, there's one event that I describe in the book where there was a convention that April said, we need to get that to that convention to get to the specific general to get this okayed so that we can bring this healthcare these needs, these healthcare needs to the veterans of the Jersey Shore that they don't have access to. We need to go to this. And they actually got the former CEO of the hospital to come with them. And this, that CEO of the hospital said, you know, Jim was at the bottom of the driveway at 5 a.m. ready to go. Him and April jumped in and, the, you know, they talked about their plan, how they were going to get the general. And again, though, people started to see things about Jim that seemed a little strange, but it wasn't glaring. In that specific case, when they were headed to this convention, the former CEO of the hospital at the time is a man named Rick Pittman. He comes from a military family, and he himself had actually served. And Jim mentioned to him that he served in Vietnam. And he asked him a couple, the former CEO, Rick Pittman, asked Jim Kaufman a couple questions about it. He said Jim Kaufman pretty much shut down. But as somebody who served around the time of Vietnam, he knew that some people shut down when they started to talk about it because of what they had seen. It seemed weird, his responses didn't really seem accurate. But at the same time, he just thought, okay, well, this is clearly a guy that's doing good, you know, really trying to help veterans out. And maybe it's just something that he doesn't talk about anymore because he has PTSD or something along those lines. And the more that April became more visible and attached to the veterans' cause, and part of that was through her work on the radio program where she became such a staunch advocate, and now she had a voice in more ways than one by having this radio show, the more that the cracks in Jim's story about military service started to become apparent. I don't know where you want to take it from there, Dan. So.
Yeah. What about the relationship with her daughter, Kim? You say she's an adult by this time, so she's having conversations with her mother. And so you talk about these cracks in the relationship, and you talk about that she eventually finds out that he was not in the military. But
yeah. And
what
so, well,
did she has
these,
friends...
Oh, sorry.
You say she has close friends and she has this close relationship with her daughter. What does she impart, if anything, about these cracks in this perfect, seemingly perfect relationship, does she impart to some friends and or her daughter?
Well, I will say early on in their marriage, there was definitely problems. And neighbors and close friends all kind of had stories about what they describe as Jim's dark side. So early on, people started to see that this was not picture perfect. It was very close to her. And a lot of it seemed to center around money. And when I say that, it would be, you know, April would have different ventures that she would do, different, you know, she wanted to be an entrepreneur. And so she had started a hair salon, and her and Jim had actually bought a hair salon together. And there was issues with that. Then she had a catering company and a restaurant, and they were losing money on it. Jim was really upset with her about that. And then there was a lot of talk of, or she would, not a lot, she wouldn't put a lot on her daughter as far as telling her every single bad thing that was going on. But towards the end of April's life, her daughter was able to, you know, kind of piece together more from what her friends were then telling her. And when basically all these stories, when they came together, was it appeared that there was years of a pretty volatile relationship. And April had kind of in passing mentioned to a friend about a really bad fight that they had had a couple years prior to her death, where he fired a gun. And when April had described it to her friend, she said a specific room that it had happened in. And there was no police report ever filed, nothing of that nature. But years later, when there's a search warrant on the house, the police went to that area after hearing the story from the friend. And sure enough, they found a bullet in the hardwood floor. And so there was a lot of things that seemed to really come to a head in 2011 leading up to her death. You know, they would hear all these different stories, but then there were certain things, like there was trips like there was a trip that they had took together in to Arizona. They had another home in Arizona. And, you know, Kim got like a frantic call from her mom saying that there was all these prescriptions that were, she found in her name, in April's name, that April hadn't filled. And they were antipsychotic medications. And when she confronted Jim about it, Jim was just real calm about it and said, you know, oh, it's just a mistake. It was a bad habit. Whenever I call in prescriptions for other people, sometimes I mistakenly give your name. It's just like an odd response,
wow.
You know.
Sure.
The Christmas prior to April's murder, Jim had apparently threatened to go nuclear on Kim and her children. And according to April, you know, he was waving a gun when he said this. But at that point, there was already pretty much a family rift where Jim's behavior had just been bizarre over the years in the sense that they never felt like he ever really wanted them over there. Like I had described April, she, you know, she wanted to have the house with the food and the holidays and the big family gatherings. And, you know, at 9 o'clock at night, when Jim was ready for the night to be over, he would turn the lights off. He would, you know, basically tell people to leave. He would do bizarre things. He'd dress up in his military outfit, wear all of his medals. He'd show off his gun collection, a room that he had that was just purely for making bullets, like just bizarre things that those closest to April felt were either him grandstanding or him doing to make people feel uncomfortable and to specifically embarrass April. And so a lot of this really came to a head in 2011, and April just really couldn't take it anymore. But what she had, I guess, been suspecting for a while was that he never served in the military. And one of the things that was the first sign of that was the type of expansion of healthcare services that they were trying to push for veterans at the Jersey Shore that they didn't have access to at the time. There was a form that doctor's offices could fill out in order to carry this insurance. And on the form, it actually, there was a box on there that said, you know, did you serve, meaning for the medical professional, are you a veteran? And that piece of paper just kind of sat on his desk for a long time, making April say, hey, like, you know, I'm the one on the radio. We're the ones pushing this. We're going to conventions in Virginia, like, you know, getting up at 5 a.m. Why won't you fill this out? And it was around that time that, you know, those closest to her say, like, part of her felt that she knew what the answer was, but she was scared to find out. And ultimately, she found out the truth that he had never served in the military. And that is when she started to realize, okay, there's other things here that just aren't right. She had a lot of questions about money. Prior to her death, Kim had learned that she had gone to a forensic accountant. However, later on, no one could ever find any record of the forensic accountant.
Right.
So they don't know if she just made an appointment but didn't follow through with it or what it was, but she had talked about going to someone, you know, to do that. And he had always kept her on a financial leash. I mean, in so many marriages, though, I mean, you hear about, you know, one's a spender, one's not, and there's usually a, you know, a yin and a yang when it comes to that. And it just seemed like
sure.
That's how they were, that he was the one that, you know, was pretty tight trying to, you know, keep things on a budget. And she wanted to decorate the new home that they bought and, you know, right away. And it wasn't anything extraordinary. You know, she wasn't going out buying Bentleys or, you know, anything like that. They just seemed to have different spending habits. And so he would write her checks, but also give her cash for a lot of the work that they were doing in 2011. When they bought the Arizona home, and there was, you know, contract work to be done and furniture to be bought. And so he was giving her a lot of cash at the time to do it. He didn't want her using credit cards. So I think that there began to be questions of, you know, where is this money coming from? And so that's kind of what it was. It seemed that every time that April wanted to find out answers, it became a really scary, overwhelming, you know, thought to her of what am I going to uncover? But she was dead leading up to her death because she really thought this is a man that she was going to grow old with. You know, she was, you know, nearing 50. She didn't want to start all over again. He had all the money. She didn't have the money. She was volunteering pretty much. She was a philanthropist. She didn't have her salon anymore. She didn't have a restaurant anymore. She had a little bit of her catering business. And she was scared. She was scared, but she loved him. It wasn't that she didn't use him as a gravy train or anything. She really, truly loved him. Even though their courtship wasn't one that had the big wedding or anything like that. I mean, they eloped, actually. And some of her friends were telling her, you know, be cautious when they got together. So, but other people, I will say, you know, and all the people that I interviewed, there are also friends that said that, you know, they went away on a trip with Jim and April to Arizona and it was fine. Everything was normal. And that's according to a friend and his daughter who traveled with them just 2 months prior to her murder. So it seemed when you take all that information and all the interviews that you get from people on a wide spectrum and you take a step back, it seems like this was a tumultuous marriage with ups and downs, but there were ups. There were ups. And so some people said that they've never looked at Jim as being this person capable of doing this. They saw him as a guy who loved his wife. And then there's other people that said, no, there was this dark side to him, and we have no doubt that he did it.
Let's get to May 9th, 2012. April's live on a radio program, The King Arthur Show in Ocean City, New Jersey, the studio of WIBG-ME, and she's co-hosting with King Arthur Gropper. This was a big day for her with something called TRICARE. Tell us a little bit about this TRICARE and why this is a big day, and then what her and her co-workers do in celebration of this big event after the radio show.
Well, to give you kind of an idea about TRICARE, so it was a huge accomplishment that she had done. She was a civil volunteer, for starters, again, because she was in the military. TRICARE is paid for by the Pentagon. It provides health care to more than 5 million Americans. And Shore Medical, which is the main hospital in their region serving the Jersey Shore, they provide the plan TRICARE, I should say, rather, provides health care services for active duty United States military and retirees with 20 or more years of service, as well as to their dependents. But there wasn't a facility in their region, including that hospital I just mentioned, that provided the types of care and accepted TRICARE. So there were certain things. So there were veterans, and it wasn't a huge amount of veterans in that region at the time, but, I mean, they're people. They served our country. And they deserve, you know, the same medical care as any other veteran in any part of the country that has access to, you know, to the correct facilities. And so if you were basically a veteran that had cancer, that had kidney issues, and you needed chemotherapy or dialysis, rather than if you were a veteran that was, say, in Philadelphia and you would take a shuttle to the VA hospital, you instead would have to take a school bus to a facility in Delaware, which could be like a 2 to 3 hour drive on a school bus with no bathroom. You'd have to get your treatment there. If you felt sick enough, they would put you up sometimes in a hotel if you had chemotherapy. But that wasn't all the time for dialysis patients. It was a bad situation. And one of the things that really put April over when she heard about it was because at the time there was a petition campaign to try to make sure that the veterans in the area would have access like every other veteran would. And they dubbed themselves, a group of the veterans that were, you know, on this bus to dialysis and chemotherapy, dubbed themselves the Coffee Can Gang. And that's because since there are no bathrooms, and I mean, people that, you know, go through those types of treatments, I mean, it wreaks havoc on your system. They would have to go to the bathroom in like a coffee can and like pass it around. It was awful. Oh. And so when she heard that, she's like, this cannot keep happening. There has to be a way to figure this out. And so there was another guy, he's an amazing man that I got to know too. His name's Bob Frollo. He's head of the Veterans Services for Atlantic County area. He was also a veteran himself too. He began the petition campaign to push for the improvements. And he at the time was working closely with the former CEO, former CEO, Rick Pittman, who was the CEO of Shore Memorial, that big hospital there at the time. And Rick Pittman was all about it too, but they were running into a lot of like red tape issues with Veterans Affairs. And that's what was the problem. It was like bureaucratic stuff. And when April got onto the scene, suddenly she just put her claws into it, and she got her husband involved to help. And they basically, because of his working relationship with the hospital and his good reputation, plus their hard work, they were then able to get TRICARE expanded to the region. And it took a lot of time. It took, you know, all the lobbying that April and Jim did was all, you know, no one paid for their airfare, for their travel, for anything. I mean, it was all, they were boots on the ground themselves and just connecting all the right people. And so that day on May 9th, which is the day before her murder, is when she was able to make the announcement that this was happening, that this is going to happen at Shore Memorial now. And right. During that week, that period of time, it wasn't just that, which was a huge feat in itself. She also just received a really distinguished award, the New Jersey State Governor's Jefferson Award, and that was for her work on veterans' behalf. So she was getting acknowledgement from the very people that a lot of these veterans couldn't get in front of. So not only did she get this issue in front of them, get it tackled, she now was getting accolades, and not just accolades from the people and the petition writing campaign. She was getting accolades from the governor, from, you know, high up politicians. People were noticing April's impact and the work that she did solely as a volunteer. And even with the radio show, I mean, she didn't make any money off of doing that. And she just was, her voice was getting louder, all for the right reasons, all for good things. And so when she got on the radio on May 9th, she was really emotional. And it's one of those things where in hindsight, you really listen very closely to the sentences that she said, and it gives you chills. And one of the things she said was, she opened with was, "I feel like I'm on borrowed time here." And it gives you chills thinking the next day she was dead. She was on borrowed time. She just didn't really know it. And she even became very reflective throughout the entire broadcast, talking about, you know, wanting to leave her legacy and her planet to her daughter and her grandchildren. And she did, you know, she patted herself on the back like, you know, she should, saying, you know, "I did the work." She was really emotional about it. And, you know, she had a couple people on the show that day. She had people calling in, and they were excited. They were happy. They were proud of themselves, and they were happy for the work that they did that was going to help the veterans. But being April Kaufman, she wasn't one to then rest on her laurels for the next couple of months. Like, okay, I did that. It was right away. What's next? What am I going to do next? And she even started talking about, you know, trying to help homeless veterans and what should it be? I don't have a job now. Like, we did what we needed to do. And she was happy. She was emotional. She was reflective. She was all these type of things, but it might be for somebody else who then, say, passed away the next day, tragically or not. They might be things that were just a conversation that somebody remembers them having, but this was broadcasted on the radio. And there's just so many things that she said that just made you think. In a weird way, it's almost like she subconsciously knew that the next day was the last day of her life.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We all want to do the right thing to keep our bodies healthy in the long run. But even if we try really hard to eat kale salads and drink green smoothies, we're still most likely not getting all of the essential nutrients we need on a daily basis. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that can do more harm to your body than good. Two easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to support a strong foundation for your health. My wife Lisa has been taking Ritual for almost 4 months now. She really loves that there's no stores she has to visit. Ritual's research into creating this vitamin really was impressive, she felt. And she feels Ritual is helping her feel better and says she can feel the difference Ritual has made. From D3 to omega-3, Ritual's Essential for Women helps fill gaps in a women's diet. Their no-nausea capsule design is gentle on an empty stomach, and there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh, so you don't get that fishy aftertaste common with most omega-3s. A subscription is easy to start. It's only $1 a day to have all the essential nutrients your body needs, delivered every month, no strings attached. Better health doesn't happen overnight, and right now Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Fill in the gaps in your diet with Essential for Women, a small step that helps support a healthy foundation for your body. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, April, we were talking about the last day that anyone had heard from April after this TRICARE announcement on the radio with her co-hosts, with her guests and the co-host. They went out to celebrate. Tell us what the story now reverts to Dr. James Kaufman in terms of what happened when she got home. Let's pick up the story from there.
So afterwards, she asked her co-host, do you want to, grab a bite, grab a drink? And she went out with the two people who were guests that day on the radio show. And they just went to a local bar, and they weren't there for too long. And they just had a drink, and then she headed home. And according to Jim, and according to her cell phone records, Jim had sent her a text saying around 5 o'clock saying that he's home. And pretty much the rest of what happened is from Jim's perspective. Right. And according to, what he told authorities. And his story would change a little bit between what he told them initially and then years later when he was deposed in a civil deposition. But what he said initially to authorities was that they talked about redoing their kitchen. They had some steaks. He said that they were amorous that night, that then pretty much they were making plans for having, dinner with friends the next week. And it was a pretty uneventful night that he described. And then he told a time that he saw her was when he was leaving for work the next morning, which was really early, around 5:30, and that he saw her stirring under the pillow. She always slept with a pillow over her head. What her cell phone records show, and according to close friends, was a little interesting. So at the time, the iPhone was new, that was when people were phasing out of their Blackberries.
Right.
And I say that because I've gotten some feedback a little bit about some of the things that transpired from people having made the transition from a Blackberry to an iPhone, that she was playing around with it. Like, she didn't know how to work Siri and all that kind of stuff. And at the same time, she was trying to make plans with a really good friend of hers who also happened to be a pharmaceutical sales rep that did work with Jim as well. And so the two of them talked a little bit on the phone, but also were texting. It was to make plans for dinner like the next week or the next weekend. And after that, she was doing some stuff on Facebook. And then overnight, people that were close to her said that they received extreme messages from her phone. So a lot of people were receiving forwarded emails from her that were dated like months before, like they were getting them in batches. But then some people were saying that they were, even though she had already responded to those emails months before, it looks like that she was responding to these emails that she was forwarding at 1:30 in the morning of that, the morning of her death.
Right.
And some people have since said, since they read the book, they said, you know, I had a BlackBerry when I made a transition. I had all these weird things that happened with my emails, things of that nature. You know, the other thing that people have thought and brought up as a possible idea is that maybe it was something that Jim was doing to try to establish that she was awake or she was up, trying to establish, you know, some sort of timeline. But the thing that was really strange didn't so much have to do with the emails. It was more about a text message that she sent to, there was a guy, Billy Gonzalez, who had done a lot of like handiwork for her for years. I mean, they had a really big house and she had a lot of things to be done and she had birds, this whole room of birds. And so he would clean and feed the birds. And in all the years that he had worked for, it was like 5 years, she'd never once sent him a text message saying, see you in the morning, or are you going to be here in the morning? It was just kind of known that she always left the door unlocked. They kind of had set days that she knew that he was going to come in and out. And he said he never received a reminder text from her in the 5 years he worked for her. But that morning at 3:30 in the morning, she sent him a text that said, see you in the morning.
And that's not a mistake in text, like that could be ruled out, like forwarded messages accidentally because you're not aware of, familiar with the phone. That is a very specific and very coincidental and odd text, isn't it? Time-wise and everything-wise.
Yeah, it was very peculiar. And it was not something that is in the course of her normally doing, specifically not with Billy Gonzalez, who, by the way, has been totally ruled out as ever being, you know, anyone that ever could be a suspect. Ultimately, he is the one who discovered April.
Right.
The next day, which I don't know if you want to go into that yet, but
sure.
He made the discovery. But do you want me to get into that?
Well, let me ask this, how does he come to discover the body, very interestingly, too? He does things around the house, but this is not really customary, the request he has to go check on her. Tell us about this request.
So that morning, Jim Kaufman was very clear about what he did, almost to the point that it raised eyebrows for the investigators on the day. To a T, he said to them that he left the house at, you know, 5:30 in the morning, like he always does. He talked about going to specific convenience stores at specific times. He went to at least two different ones. He was looking for the paper. He talked about doing his rounds at the hospital, and then that he went into the office. And he also said that him and April would always talk like throughout the day constantly. And so that morning he was making it clear to a lot of people that he hadn't heard from her at all. So he decided to call Billy, and Billy said it wasn't normal for Jim Kaufman to call him. But it was probably around 9:30 in the morning, the day of that she was discovered, that Jim Kaufman first called Billy. And Jim then says that he went ahead to a doctor's appointment that he had of his own. And it was around that time, around just after 11 o'clock in the morning, that he called Billy again to check on April because he hadn't heard from her. And that's when Billy kept him on the phone. He went into her room and he found her lying on the floor face down. And initially, he only saw a cut on her arm, and he said that she wasn't moving. So Dr. Kaufman headed straight there and called 911 also. And when he arrived, he saw his wife's body, and he didn't touch her, and he didn't try to resuscitate her. And he said to authorities that day, the reason why is because he saw lividity. He said, you know, I've been a physician for 30 years. I know when somebody is dead. And when the police and more people started arriving, they saw him on the front lawn, and he was, the way that they describe it is, he was visibly upset that he was yelling over and over, she's dead, why now? As they were, medics were upstairs pronouncing her dead. But what the police said, and actually specifically put in their notes that day, was that he never cried, he didn't shed a tear, and he was so specific about his alibi that morning, and even said things along the lines of, oh, yeah, you could get that on the surveillance camera from the convenience store. Right. You know, you'd be able to see this, you know. And, I mean, he gives very specific times also of that morning, and that's where the, you know, authorities thought that there was something a little bit strange. And then the rest of the day, he called Kim to tell her, he called friends of April's to tell them, and he called his office to tell, and he was very close with a lot of the people in his office. So then everybody descends on the house. So now everybody that's in April's inner circle is basically in the living room, which, I mean, I've been to umpteenth amount of crime scenes in, you know, the 20 years that I've been doing this, and I don't normally see in a home where somebody is murdered, you know, a gathering of people downstairs watching as the detectives are doing it. So that seemed a little strange. But so he basically had a lot of people around him, but then he was giving information, saying things along the lines of, oh, she was shot with a 20. Once they were told that she was in fact murdered, because at the time when they saw her body, it wasn't clear to people, it wasn't clear to Jim that she had been shot, or to Billy. It looked like she just had a cut on her arm because she was still face down. But after they found out that this was in fact a homicide investigation, he started saying to people, oh, she was shot with a 22, when police had never told him that. And that's another like suspicion that was raised. And then his demeanor was really strange at the scene. I mean, even to give people a benefit of the doubt, I don't know how I would react if my loved one was shot to death in the bedroom. I don't know what my reaction would be, but his reaction changed where towards the end, he's saying to detectives things that he wanted to get out of the house, his medication, but then he also wanted his Tom Collins mix. He also wanted, you know, a specific type of whiskey. He started joking around with them. He asked if he could get back into the house. And then and during all of this, these detectives are writing down the things that they're describing as strange behavior. And then he said to them, by the way, detective, if you ever have to put handcuffs on me, be careful. I have a very bad shoulder. And that was something where the detectives were like, okay, this is strange. And almost immediately he did reach out to a defense attorney, which again, looking at both sides of something, I don't fault people who are, especially a husband of a murder victim, for reaching out to the defense attorney, because you don't understand the CIS process. But he did reach out to a defense attorney, and within a matter of days, he did retain him. Not just any defense attorney, mind you. He is based in Atlantic City, but he's one of the most experienced defense attorneys with a heavy roster of clientele with the mafia. He's very good. He tries a lot of white collar crime, a lot of complicated cases. And, you know, he's been in the media a lot too. He's very media savvy. He's a very good attorney. So he hired someone very, very capable as well. So it was then his demeanor after it that people started watching really closely. That was really bizarre. You know, obviously he's under like such scrutiny, but Kim right away thought that he had something to do with it, just knowing the type of relationship that her parents had, knowing his demeanor, knowing the type of person that he was. And when it came to planning her funeral, he actually got up and spoke at the funeral, And he kept his sunglasses on the entire time. She didn't see him cry at all. When they came to the point to bury her mom and they were at the cemetery, when he got out of the they all were traveling in a limo. There was just some peculiar things. You know, Kim remembers seeing a couple of the detectives from the prosecutor's office there, and he seemed to freak out and call his defense attorney to ask why they were there. There were just a lot of his behavior started to get really peculiar, specifically when they're of the Jewish faith. So they sat Shiva for April. And while they were there, she said it was almost like no one had died. Like he was just planning his next steps, like telling people, oh, come out and visit in Arizona. And she said his demeanor was just strange. But the worst part was is that nobody really seemed scared or concerned in regards to finding a killer. Like even the initial day that it happened, where their house was located, it was right next to a huge high school. And the high school was never put on lockdown. And from the get-go, the prosecutor's office was like, okay, well, we don't believe that there's a threat to the community. Which in those situations, right. It usually means that they know who did it, you know, or, you know, usually they have an idea that of who did it or, you know, so there was just a lot of things of that nature that were strange. But the thing that was also strange was in just a matter of weeks, he started dating again.
Right.
And the way that he described it was that a woman that he had dated when he was in caught on a break from college and she was in high school reached out to give her condolences and they ended up dating again, but it was pretty quick. And she's I don't want to say too much about her for legal reasons, but she's a very well-educated, well-established woman. And, you know, I described their courtship in the book. She became very involved in his business in the sense that she was helping him find employees and whatnot. And it was just a month to the day that April was buried, you know, they were already seen having dinner together. And some people could, you know, say, some people in his office were like, listen, he was sad and he was lonely and we were happy for him. You know, there were some people that didn't think that he had anything to do with April's death. But underneath it all, what nobody knew, and I would hear inklings of, I heard rumors, was almost immediately after April's death, the police already started to put together the pieces of the connection with the pagans and the connection with narcotics from Jim's office. And it started to look like to them that there was this whole other side of Jim that nobody had any idea of the depths of it.
Let's talk about Kim a little bit as well, because at this funeral and afterwards, she tried to give the illusion or give the impression to her stepfather that she didn't suspect him in case she could get some information. But at some point, she had a conversation with him, and he said things like, well, she asked, why don't you cooperate with the police? Now, why don't you go to them? And he said, listen, I have a really expensive attorney, and he's advised me not to do anything. So when you talk about nonchalance with his stepdaughter, he shocked her with the kinds of things he said, his disregard for April, period. Let's fast forward, because we must, to know that this police investigation was frustrated along the way, and Kim has to wait, as we mentioned in the introduction, till a fortunate break happens for investigators. And then we talk about the civil case and what prompted this civil case and Kim's participation. So tell us about what happens with the investigation briefly, and then this break in this civil case and the need for this civil case and what happens as a result.
Yeah, so Kim for a while was trying to stay in Jim's good graces because she was she was like a double agent in a sense. She wanted to get as much information out of him as she could, but it hit a point where she couldn't anymore. And especially when he asked her if it was okay if she could date, she just couldn't believe that he was doing absolutely nothing for her mom, specifically because her mom was the type of person that if the tables were turned, her mom would have done everything to find out who had harmed him. And so probably in an, it was in 2013 that the one thing that wasn't resolved was that there were two insurance policies, life insurance policies that were taken out on April, and Kim forgot about them. She didn't even think about them. But Jim actually called the insurance company and said, I want to be able to receive the monies from these insurance policies. And they said, well, listen, you know, we need to know that you've been cleared and that you're not a suspect in this crime. Otherwise, we can't give you that money. And the prosecutor's office had been very quiet, completely quiet with the media. I mean, really said nothing over all these years. And the times that we would reach out to them to say, hey, what can we do? Do you want us to find out, you know, this could shake the trees a little if we do another story on this. They wanted absolutely no help. And even though they were making some headway behind the scenes, at least immediately after her murder, with the connections to the Pagans, and then connecting it to Jim, it wasn't enough for them to take that leap, to go that far. So totally randomly, Jim does this with the insurance company. And then since Kim was another benefactor on the insurance money, they had to reach out to her and basically said, hey, you know, if he doesn't get like this, you're going to have to fight for this money. Otherwise it could ultimately go to him. And we have to basically draw you into this lawsuit. So you need to get counsel. And she went ahead and she reached out to one big firm. They weren't helpful. So she reached out to, it was like the 11th hour. Like, I think she had like only like 2 days left or something until basically everything would go to Jim if he had been cleared. And at this point, the prosecutor's office is like, no, we can't say you're a suspect. We can't say you're not a suspect. This is still an ongoing investigation. Kim reaches out to a personal injury firm. I don't want to say tiny because they had some pretty big cases, but all personal injury. They weren't former prosecutors. They weren't criminal defense attorneys at all. And she said, listen, this is my situation. And it's these two brothers. And they said, you know what? We'll take your case. And Kim had never publicly said, I think my stepfather had something to do with this. She never said that because she wanted to really put her faith in the justice system. And she didn't want to go against anything. You know, when she would talk to the media, she didn't want to make it seem like she was against the prosecutor's office. And she wanted to support them. She wanted to be supportive. When she hired these attorneys, they decided to file actually a wrongful death suit and tried to say that Jim shouldn't be able to get the money because of the Slayer statute, which is basically if you murder someone, you can't make any money off of them, you know, because of the crime. And because of that, when that lawsuit was filed, it was the first time that it was really Kim versus the stepfather. But along with doing that, the attorneys were able to put all their private investigators on the case. And even though they had gone to the prosecutor's office to say, hey, you know, we're building this civil case against him. What can you give us? What from your files? They were like, no, we're not going to give you anything from our investigatory files. So they started their own investigation from scratch. And they ended up re-interviewing people, finding other people that hadn't been interviewed. I had actually given them some information in regards to finding out that Jim, in fact, wasn't a veteran, because we had gone back and forth about doing a story locally on Jim not being a veteran, because at the time it didn't qualify whether it's a stolen valor, because stolen valor, you have to prove that you've stolen money and benefit off of it that way. And these two brothers became obsessed with the case along with their private investigators, who asked not to be named, but I wish that they had been okay with it, because one guy in particular, I mean, he just did a slam dunk job. I was really impressed with him. And they found out all of this information. And then what happened was when it got, they were able to actually depose Jim. And it would be the only time that Jim would ever be in court. And they just right from the bat, when they got him on the stand for that deposition, it wasn't a stand, it was, you know, a table in a lawyer's office, but they got him on tape. And they used that opportunity to ask every question that they possibly could, that if he had been on the stand in a criminal case, would have been you know, a prosecutor just kind of going at him. And that's where they found discrepancies from the initial statement that he had given to the police on the day of that April was found. They were able to get on the record all of these discrepancies and even more information. And that's what really, that the momentum then, what just like picked way up. But the thing was, from the outside looking in, no one knew about all this because these depositions at the time were sealed. This is a civil case. It wasn't playing out in the media. So it was still only this small group of people that knew that all this was happening. But on the outside world, he was still living his life, you know? And that's, again, like if he was still, he wasn't arrested. He wasn't prevented from doing anything. What was also happening at the same time was he was running two basically Medicare fraud scams out of his office.
Right.
And the authorities were on to him about that. And it's interesting because he's running these scams in there and yet poking the bear about the life insurance policies. It almost makes you think, like, this guy really can't be guilty, because who in their right mind would, you know, you think you just want, if you think you just want to go away. You know what I mean? Just, you know, forget about the money. I'm a free man. I'm not arrested for anything. But instead, he's not only running two fraudulent schemes out of his office, now he's also pushing to get this money off of his wife's death that, you know, authorities believe he was involved with. And Kim is really the one that kept the foot on the pedal with all this, keeping it going.
Right. You talk about this 2017, Judge DeLury and Damon Tyner, Atlanta County prosecutor. So this person wanted to keep this case going as well. And then you talk about another person that's crucial, an FBI special agent, Dan Garibrandt, comes on board. Tell us about the circumstances that Damon Tyner in 2017 looks at this case, and tell us about the agent Garibrandt and his involvement here.
So in 2017, in New Jersey, you get appointed by the governor when he decides which prosecutor he wants in which county. So Damon's appointed in 2017, and one of the first things he wanted to do was he wanted to solve all the homicides in the county, unsolved homicides, and April's was one of them. And so it's a small area, too, so everybody kind of knows each other, but he welcomed any information that people had. And so the Darcy brothers, who are the Kim civil attorneys, went ahead and they said, listen, we want to give you a presentation about all the information that we have. We don't know what you already have in your investigatory file because we could never see it. And so they went in and they spent a couple of hours and they basically laid everything out. And in some of the findings that the Darcy brothers had was that they felt were significant was a phone. There was a phone number that called Jim's phone more than 300 times between August of 2011, and it stopped all phone calls May 9th of 2012. And
incredible.
They weren't sure, could that be a girlfriend of Jim's? Was that the hitman? Because there's a theory, running theory, that some people in their mind thought was Jim hired someone to kill her. And
right. They
couldn't figure it out. But they said to them, listen, if you find out who this really is, because it was a burner phone, one of those throwaway phones, and it was registered to a name, Harry Johnson, and it was a bogus name and a bogus address. They said, if you figure this out, this could be your guy. So authorities have never really said how much they knew about that phone and if they already knew about it and just never moved on it. But the Darcys felt that it was very significant. And they gave everything else to authorities and said, whatever you need, have at it. Like, we will help you in whatever way we can. From there, they started looking through what they already had. And there was also a note on there that Jim Kaufman's DNA had never been requested. A lot of cases when the two people are living together, obviously your DNA is going to be everywhere, you know, but There was a specific blood specimen that they had wanted to check, but they never were able to get Jim's DNA. In fact, the only time that Jim had ever talked to authorities was the day April was discovered. Beyond
right.
that, when they had reached, when the prosecutor's office had reached out to him and his attorney, they actually let his attorney write a letter answering questions just in a letter. And it wasn't even that extensive. So, and that's important to note because there's two things that happened in 2017. Besides Damon Tyner basically saying, okay, we're going to put together a group of people on this case. We're going to have you go over the file, see what the Darcys have, and move forward. One of the first things that they did was they filed in order to try to compel Jim Kaufman to give a sample of his DNA. Well, they had to go to court to handle that. At the same time, they had received a letter from Jim Kaufman and his attorney in 2000, and right when Damon came into office, and the letter said on it, there are two people, we don't know to the extent of how these people may or may not be involved in the case, but there's two people you need to look into, Ferdinand Augello and Francis Mulholland. And it was like these two names. And they actually didn't even notice the letter for a while. It like went into like a random folder. And when they saw that, they thought, okay, this is strange. Well, Ferdinand Augello is a former leader of the Pagan Motorcycle Gang, had since been retired. And Francis Mulholland was a guy that pretty much had just like a history of like issues with drugs, but wasn't necessarily affiliated with any motorcycle gangs. So they have that. They're asking to go before a judge to try to get a sample of Jim Kaufman's DNA. They go to court. Jim Kaufman's not in court, but his lawyer is. And it was a significant court proceeding because it was the first time that anybody was in court in regards to April's murder, like any hearing or anything. And so we started to learn more, we being the media and the public, about pieces of this investigation. That in itself created such a momentum that it put everybody that would be accused of and convicted of being involved in April's murder on guard. And it created a massive sense of paranoia. So in May is when the judge ruled that Kaufman would have to give a sample of his DNA. And it was just a month later that they went to serve a search warrant on his office in Egg Harbor Township. And when they arrived to serve the warrant, which was specifically for Medicare fraud,
right.
and also said anything in relation to the murder of April Kaufman, but it was mainly for Medicare fraud stuff, he pulls a gun out of his scrubs at his doctor's office, a loaded gun that he just had in his scrub pants, and he points it at himself. But you know how those things can go, and the authorities pull their weapons. I mean, they had FBI, they had local police, and basically a standoff ensues. And they get him for a weapons violation, and that was the last time that Jim Kaufman ever walked free. If he hadn't pulled a gun, he probably would have been out on bail. And that was really the beginning of the end.
The investigators put this case together. What do they find in terms of this Pagan pill mill and the connection in their connection to this assassination by Dr. Jim Kaufman? In their mind, that's their theory. Tell us what they pieced together for the motive for this in terms of the Pagans being involved.
So their theory is that Jim was running a pill mill with members of the Pagan Motorcycle Gang working out of his office. Authorities actually knew that Jim was prescribing narcotics to only a small group of people in July 2012. They were able to figure that out. That went on from all the way up until 2017. And basically it would be like about seven people, all somehow an associate of the Pagans, if not a Pagan themselves. But this wasn't a Pagan operation because it was being run without the mother chapter's knowledge. So you got Andrew Glick, who's still a pagan, but you got Fred, who authorities say was running the pill mill, and he's a former pagan. But they're all people that were somehow, shape, or form related to the pagans. So the idea was is that they were basically selling the drugs. Jim was getting some sort of kickback. He was getting cash each time that the pagans would come into the office in order to get them. And they're saying that that's what the operation was. And then from there, authorities said that there was other nefarious things that were going on, like the Medicare fraud that I was talking about too, where he actually was getting kickbacks from doctors. And it almost seemed like he was making more money off of that. So some people wonder, was it just that he got caught up with the pagans and what he thought was a good idea, and then it was a situation where he just couldn't get out, you know, like to separate from them. But what happens is, in order for police to connect the dots, in right after the, I call when he got arrested outside of his office, the beginning of the end. And it's actually really interesting how it came to be, because there's a couple people that are notable from the pagans in this, and it's Andrew Glick ends up being the ultimate, the witness that they hang everything on, prosecutors. So Andrew Glick says that Fred Augello was the leader running the pill mill, and there were a couple other people helping. And Andrew Glick, when the records were taken, when the authorities raided the office, they took everybody's medical records. Well, Andrew Glick was basically a patient of Kaufman's for the sole purpose of getting narcotics and selling them among the pagans, and there are about seven people that were doing that. But he also had a legitimate medical condition. He had diabetes, so he had an actual medical file with Dr. Kaufman. And the authorities made an announcement a couple weeks after Dr. Kaufman's arrest that basically said, hey, if you're a patient of Dr. Kaufman's and you need your medical records, come to the prosecutor's office and we'll give you your medical records. So totally surprised to them, Andrew Glick calls and says, hi, my name is Andrew Glick. I want to get my medical records. They said, okay, make an appointment. He comes down, he goes, walks into the prosecutor's office. And at this point, he doesn't know that they have this letter, the letter with the name Ferdinand is also Fred. Fred is a nickname for Ferdinand Augello and Francis Mulholland. So they're able to see, obviously, that Andrew has, you know, connections to, well, and he comes in and he's like, oh my gosh, you know, and he ends up getting his medical records and leaving. And he's so spooked that an entirely separate illegal drug operation that he has going, which is basically selling meth and pills out of his Egg Harbor Township house, he stops that for a little bit, thinking that, okay, they got their eyes on me. He tells Fred. Fred becomes, you know, nervous about everything. And then after a couple of months, he figured, okay, nobody's bothered me. No one's, you know, I'm good. So he starts up his drug business again. And they come and they raid his house and they flip him. And once Andrew Glick gets flipped by the authorities, after they tell him like everything they have, they say, you need to wear a wire and we need you to get, we believe that Ferdinand Augello is the one that, you know, carried out the search and ultimately the hit to kill April Kaufman. Andrew Glick himself brought information to the table exactly like that as well, also stemming from a 2011 separate drug operation that he had running that the feds actually knew about, but he was never arrested for, that he was running pills to pagans in Florida. While he was running that operation, he told them that he kept hearing rumors that somebody was looking for a hitman to kill the doctor's wife. And it was well known among the members of the pagans about what they were doing. And that was just months prior to when she actually got murdered, which is actually really sad to think about, that if somebody had actually said something, that her murder could have been prevented. But so with all of that information that they have, authorities now have momentum. They have Kaufman in jail. They have this letter. They arm Glick with the letter. They put a wire on him. They know that he has access to Fred. And they basically just start recording every conversation that Andrew Glick has with Fred Augello, between the wire that he's wearing and meeting him in his van or in his house. And also, they are able to extend the warrant so that they're now tracking Fred's phone to see who, separate from Andrew, he's calling and he's texting. And they basically give the letter to Glick to give to Fred. And once Fred sees that his name is on this letter, you know, they're convinced, and the narrative they're going with is that, okay, Kaufman's in jail now. He's going to flip on us. He's going to flip on us. And in one of the first recorded conversations, when Andrew is wearing the wire, you hear on the tape, you actually hear Fred say to him, you know what we have to do. And then you don't hear Fred say it, but you hear him writing something on paper. And Glick says that on a piece of paper he wrote, Kaufman will be dead in 2 days. So Glick tells authorities Fred wants Kaufman dead in jail. And through all their conversations, it starts that now it's Glick and Augello talking about who's going to kill Kaufman in jail.
Yeah.
And the whole time Kaufman is, Glick has handlers. The authorities are aware. They're keeping their eye on Kaufman to make sure that this isn't going to happen. But there was a fear that, okay, now he's in danger. And separately, since they're tracking Fred's phone, they start to say, okay, he's talking to this person, he's talking to that person. There's somebody with connections to the Philly mob. Is he trying to put a hit out on them because of the connection to the Philly mob? And the entire time, Fred is saying, I didn't do this on the wire. I didn't do this. That's what you hear a lot of. But what Glick is saying is, yeah, but he's also writing things down. But Glick never gets any of the things that were written down on the pieces of paper to the authorities. So it's half incriminating things on the wire from Fred. But in Fred's defense, he never outright says, I killed April Kaufman, or I found the hitman to kill April Kaufman. It's more of, but at the same time, it was enough to worry authorities. The conversations are very clear that they wanted Kaufman dead in jail. And it was strong enough that authorities said, you know what, Kaufman's in danger. We think that this is enough information for us to go ahead with a warrant. We think we know the whole grand scope of this entire operation. We need to get this guy arrested. And it was basically Andrew Glick that flipped and was able to get all this information. And also he got other people on recording too, talking about it. And ultimately authorities were able to get multiple former Pagans to flip. And it was all those former Pagans or Pagan associates that flipped and testified against Fred that put him in the position where he got convicted and he's serving life.
Yes, certainly. There is another tragic twist to this.
Yeah.
We'll leave that for the audience to discover in your book. Needless to say, didn't escape justice completely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about The Doctor, The Hitman, and The Motorcycle Gang, the true story of one of New Jersey's most notorious murder-for-hire plots. Thank you very much, Andy McCormick. You have a website that people might go to find out more about this story and this book?
I do. AnnieMcCormick.com you can head to, and also on Twitter, I'm very active, 6ABCAnnie. We also have The Doctor, The Hitman, The Motorcycle Gang on Instagram, and Annie McCormick TV on Instagram as well. So it's a complex story. So thank you for letting me talk about it. I hope I didn't lose anybody in the different webs that they all
have. I don't
have
think
this,
so.
But I hope that they enjoy it.
It's a fascinating story, and we didn't have enough time to get right to the very, very end. But I think that it's an incredible story. Involving so many elements, and the courageous fight that Kim Pack, was able to do with some other people that wouldn't let this case go, finally brought these tenacious players finally brought Dr. Jim Kaufman to justice, and finally his inevitable fate behind bars. I want to thank you very much, Annie McCormick, for The Doctor, the Hitman, and the Motorcycle Gang. You have a great evening.
Thank you so much, Dan. Be well.
Thank you. Good night.